It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, would a fee on hybrid vehicles in Wisconsin help fix the transportation budget? We'll find out why our guest says, not really, no. First, tensions between the United States and North Korea got even worse this weekend after a nuclear test from the isolated Asian country. North Korea's nuclear aspirations have been closely monitored by the international community. So what does this test mean for North Korea and the rest of the world? How will the international community respond if North Korea continues its pursuit of nuclear weapons and missiles that can carry them? Scott Snyder is a senior fellow for Korea Studies and director of the program on U.S.-Korea policy at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's the author of the new book, South Korea at the Crossroads, Autonomy and Alliance in an Era of Rival Powers. Scott, welcome back to Central Time.
Sure, glad to be here.
Well, North Korea has done nuclear tests in the past. Can you talk about the significance of this one, this what appears to be more powerful nuclear device?
That's right. The North Koreans claimed to have tested a thermonuclear device this time, and the estimates of yield from this test have been about 5 to 10 times greater than previous tests. So we see that North Korea is making progress. The significance of North Korea possibly having thermonuclear capability would mean that if they launched a missile in the direction of another country, the necessity of accuracy would be less because a thermonuclear device could wipe out a larger area. And so that redresses one element of weakness in North Korea's effort to try to develop a strike capability. So basically the main obstacle that North Korea still needs to overcome in order to be able to launch a weapon in the direction of the United States is really re-entry as part of an international continental ballistic missile package. And the U.S. options for trying to stop that, obviously time is limited as they make progress. And so I think that the focus of the administration has turned to both the U.N. Security Council, but also looking at additional unilateral sanctions measures that could be placed against North Korea. I'm sure that there's probably some kind of exploration of ways to improve diplomatic communication with North Korea. And then obviously the last resort option would be to try to use military force against North Korea if it were clear that the North Koreans were actually going to try to strike the United States with a nuclear capability.
Let's talk about that sanctions idea. There have been a lot of sanctions against North Korea over the years. Is there a regime of sanctions that could make a difference at this point, that North Korea would stand up and take notice and actually dial back their nuclear ambitions?
Sanctions by themselves have never been, I think, effective in causing a change in direction. It's going to have to be accompanied by some kind of diplomatic effort. But sanctions are one way of trying to put pressure on the regime. The problem in this case, I think, is that the main source or motive by Kim Jong-un to pursue a nuclear capability, I think, stems from his own sense of vulnerability. What we've seen over the course of the past 5 years is that the nuclear program has been a source of domestic legitimation for him, and the North Koreans continue to state that they'll meet pressure with pressure, and then they're not going to give in to that kind of sanctions pressure. They do have a kind of counteroffer out there, which is it feels like a kind of blackmail offer to some extent. Essentially, it's the call upon the U.S. to drop its hostile policy toward North Korea, at which time it would be possible from a North Korean perspective to engage in some kind of mutual arms control discussion.
Looking at North Korean motivation more, as I understand it, this has been an official kind of idea from North Korea saying basically, hey, look, Saddam Hussein in Iraq didn't have nuclear weapons. He's dead. His regime is gone. Muammar Gaddafi in Libya didn't have nuclear weapons. He's dead. His regime is gone. Why on earth would we give up our nuclear weapons given that precedent? Is that part of the thinking in North Korea?
Absolutely. I think that Kim Jong-un has decided, in fact, the North Korean media continuously cites those examples for why North Korea wants to hold on to this capability. And I think that Kim Jong-un has decided that he wants to be too nuclear to fail, given the track record of regime failure in places like Libya and then in Iraq.
We're talking to Scott Snyder from the Council on Foreign Relations, author of the book South Korea at the Crossroads, looking at the latest from North Korea, nuclear tests, international reaction. Want to give a listen to U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley. She says we're basically running out of diplomatic ways of dealing with North Korea. Here's a little bit of what she's had to say.
The time has come to exhaust all of our diplomatic means before it's too late. We must now adopt the strongest possible measures. Kim Jong-un's action cannot be seen as defensive. He wants to be acknowledged as a nuclear power. But being a nuclear power is not about using those terrible weapons to threaten others. Nuclear powers understand their responsibilities. Kim Jong-un shows no such understanding. His abusive use of missiles and his nuclear threats show that he is begging for war. War is never something the United States wants. We don't want it now. But our country's patience is not unlimited.
So Kim Jong-un not using nuclear weapons just for defensive purposes, begging for war. What do you make of what you've heard from Nikki Haley?
Well, I think what Ambassador Haley was really trying to dramatize the idea that we're running out of time and that this is a matter of greatest urgency. And, of course, it's necessary to try to build a sense of pressure in the international community in order to be able to pass any kind of additional sanctions resolution. But one other aspect of her comments that I think, you know, is interesting is related to the question of does North Korea understand the idea behind mutual assured destruction. If, in fact, they're looking for a defensive deterrent, we can certainly understand why North Korea might feel vulnerable in a world where they have no allies and the U.S. has nuclear weapons. But they've also threatened to use nuclear weapons for offensive purposes, and that's problematic. It has raised a lot of questions, I think, in policy circles about whether any kind of Cold War formula for mutual assured destruction would be able to hold with somebody like Kim Jong-un.
Right. The concern would be that if North Korea were to invade South Korea, I mean, they're still at war technically. The first element of that could be a nuclear strike, then followed by a land invasion?
Yes, and also the possibility that they would continue to threaten use in ways that are irresponsible or shorten the ladder of escalation. I mean, as it is, if North Korea has a capability to strike the United States, and we're not quite there yet, it means that any sign that North Korea is moving in that direction is going to heighten the prospect that the United States is going to take preemptive action. And then North Korea knows that, and so they're looking at how can we preempt U.S. preemption. And so this dramatically raises the risks of miscalculation and possible mistakes between the two countries.
We've heard from the White House possible trade sanctions against countries that don't strictly enforce trade sanctions with North Korea, stopping trade even, and that includes mainly China, not just China, but mainly China. Is that a plausible threat?
I do believe that the U.S. Treasury has the capability to impose what is called secondary sanctions against mostly Chinese customers of North Korea. And, of course, this would create complications in the U.S.-China relationship. It's possible that the U.S. could take some pretty expansive measures in that area, but it still doesn't solve the fundamental problem that we really need to have some more enhanced form of communication, leader to leader. You know, some people have compared this North Korea crisis to the Cuban Missile Crisis, but at least at that time, we know that the president of the United States and the leader of the Soviet Union were in communication with each other. But with Kim Jong-un, we really haven't established anything that looks like effective leader-to-leader communication.
Finally, I wanted to ask about South Korea. We've heard, unrelated to this, the possibility of the U.S. canceling a trade agreement with South Korea, questions about how well we're coordinating with South Korea when it comes to North Korea. How do they fit into this?
Well, South Korea is the potential victim of any kind of military conflict between the U.S. and North Korea. They would be the ones that would suffer from North Korean retaliation the most. From a strategic perspective, it really doesn't make sense to raise issues related to trade differences between the U.S. and South Korea in this kind of way at a time when you're trying to address the North Korean threat. And so I think that suggesting that the South Koreans are focused on appeasement rather than focusing on coordination effectively, you know, given the high stakes that they have in avoiding conflict, is counterproductive to our broader interest in trying to deal with the North Korea threat.
We'll leave it there for now. Scott, thanks a lot for joining us.
Sure, glad to be with you.
That's Scott Snyder, Senior Fellow for Korea Studies and Director of the Program on U.S.-Korea Policy at the Council on Foreign Relations, author of the new book, South Korea at the Crossroads. He joins us today to talk about the nuclear test North Korea conducted this weekend and U.S. diplomacy moving forward. Right now, Wisconsin is weeks behind the due date for a new state budget. The biggest sticking point has been transportation funding. The governor hasn't wanted to raise the gas tax or user fees. There's been disagreement among Republicans in the legislature. Meanwhile, Wisconsin's road and infrastructure are in need of fixing, and a lot of big construction projects are in the balance. One idea the governor likes so far, a fee increase for people who own hybrid and electric vehicles. We're just hearing news this afternoon that it looks like that will be in the final deal, an increase on user fees for those owners. Dave Cislevich joins us now. He says that's not really going to fix anything. He's a former mayor of Madison and executive director for the Wisconsin Bicycle Federation. He wrote about this issue for Isthmus newspaper. Dave, welcome back.
Rob, thanks for having me.
You call the hybrid vehicle fee a 1% solution. Why is that?
Well, it may be just a little bit more than that now. When I wrote that, it looked like it was going to be a $50 fee. The latest news is it might be as much as $100 extra fee. So just to understand how that works. Right now, everybody pays a $75 registration fee for their vehicle. It would apparently go up to about $175 under what the Republicans are going to propose later on this afternoon. The reason I call it a 1% solution is because it solves a really tiny part of the whole problem. It's been estimated that we need about $500 million a year, about $1 billion over the biennium, to fix our roads. And Wisconsin has some of the worst road conditions in the entire country. That fee $50 would have produced $5 million, or 1% of the answer. Even at $100, it's not going to produce nearly enough to solve the problem.
The idea, the principle here is, okay, a lot of our roads are paid for with the gas tax. If I'm driving an electric vehicle, I'm not paying any gas tax. If I'm in a hybrid, I'm using less gas, so I'm paying less. So why not have those users pay proportionally a little more in that user fee?
And theoretically, that makes some sense. But again, it doesn't get near to solving the problem, doesn't produce enough revenue. And as a matter of theory, actually, the better solution there is a vehicle miles traveled tax. And that's being explored in other states, including Oregon. The federal government is looking at it. There's technology on every car that can track how many miles you're driving without necessarily tracking where you're going. And that is the fairest way to do it, because it is true that hybrid and electric cars are putting wear and tear on the roads. And because they're not using as much fuel as before, they're not paying as much as they would, or in the case of electrics, at all. And so it does make some sense, but the fair way to do that is through a VMT. And by the way, the real problem that the transportation budget has isn't with hybrids and electrics, because they make about 1% of the fleet. It's with the increased gas efficiency of conventional engines.
Right. So if I'm driving a more fuel-efficient gas vehicle, I'm paying proportionally less than I would have a few years back with a less efficient
vehicle. Exactly. And that counts for 99% of the vehicles on the road.
So this is it. It seems like it's good news, right? We're using our fuel more efficiently,
right.
But it does have this bad news effect on how we pay for the roads.
And that's another problem with the special fee on hybrids and electrics. I mean, you have people who are trying to do something good for the environment, right? They're trying to burn less fossil fuels, which has benefits for all of us. And this comes off as a penalty for doing the right thing.
So how about just increasing the gas tax? That's something that the governor and half the Republicans in the legislature at least are opposed to. But what do you think of that?
Absolutely.
Idea?
It makes the most sense. I was on a Transportation Finance and Policy Commission a few years ago, and it was a bipartisan commission. We came up with a comprehensive plan, and that plan, unfortunately, has been ignored. But it did include a 5 cent per gallon increase in the gas tax. That in itself, I think a penny on the gas tax raises something like $30 million. So that's the way to raise funds quickly. A lot of states have done it. About half of all states have increased the gas tax just in the last few years. Idaho did it. They increased their gas tax by 7 cents a gallon. This is Idaho, a deep red state, very anti-tax, and a state where everybody's got to drive every place, and they found the political will to increase the gas tax.
We've seen some people on the left and the right saying, hey, maybe the problem isn't the revenue side. The problem's on the spending side. We're doing too many big projects that maybe we don't need all of them. Let's save money instead of raising taxes.
And I'm sympathetic to that argument. I think that there's something in the middle here. I'm not convinced that we need $1 billion over 2 years, but I am convinced that we need some hundreds of millions of dollars over the next 2 years just to fix what we have, because there have been more than one study that has shown that Wisconsin's roads are in bad shape. One of those studies ranked us 49th in the country in terms of the condition of our roads. And these are mostly county highways, town roads, city streets. These are the things that we need to fix. And so I'm sympathetic with people who say that we build too many highways too wide and too fancy, and we can save some money there. But even if we do, just to take care of what we have, we need some sort of revenue increase.
We're talking to Dave Cieslewicz, former mayor of Madison. He wrote about the state's transportation budget for Isthmus newspaper. He says, bad idea to raise user fees for hybrid and electric vehicles. It looks like that is now likely to happen. He's looking for other long-term fixes. And Dave, let's get to that main long-term fix you mentioned a few minutes ago, the vehicle mileage tax idea. How would that work on a practical level?
Well, the commission that I served on a few years ago proposed a low-tech solution. So one of the things that people are concerned about is the government sort of tracking your mileage. Now, the truth is, I think that is going to be a concern that goes away as millennials start to take over. This is a generation that's growing up with cell phones, tracking their every move on the internet, et cetera. Security cameras everywhere. But for my generation, I'm a baby boomer, and I understand the concern people have about Big Brother. So what we propose is something very simple, which is simply that you would take an odometer reading when you renewed your vehicle registration fee. A year later, you'd be asked to take the odometer reading again. You do some simple math, count up how many miles you had driven on that vehicle, and multiply by a fraction of a cent. And basically, it would end up being an increase on your registration, but it would be based on how many miles you drove.
Is that going to be palatable to people? It's going to feel like a brand new kind of tax and a new way to assess tax, and people might not be nuts about that.
It might feel like it, but the truth is, if we used it to supplement or replace the gas tax, it's basically the same system, only more fair, because right now, that's essentially the way it works. The more you drive, the more gas you consume. The more gas you consume, the more tax you pay. The problem is that while it's been roughly fair in the past, as vehicles become more efficient, as we get more hybrids and electrics out there, and we will, that's going to break down. So the VMT tax really is similar to what we've done with the gas tax in the past, but it's actually more fair.
Is anybody doing that right now?
Nobody's actually doing it yet. As I said, the state of Oregon is studying it. The federal government, at least under the Obama administration, was looking at it. I don't know about the Trump administration, but it was recommended in the Transportation Finance and Policy Commission report from Wisconsin that came out in 2013.
The other controversial part of the transportation debate is borrowing money. And you've run a local government. Yes. You know bonding is a thing. It's a tool that's used. Do you think we are borrowing too much right now to pay for our roads?
We are. And actually, everyone agrees with that across the board. About 25 cents on every dollar collected into the transportation fund goes to pay back debt. 20 cents is about the max. So we're already over what's recommended for a budget. I don't mind borrowing. These are long-term investments, and so it does make some sense to borrow for them. But just like in any family budget, if you're borrowing too much for your house, for your credit cards, et cetera, it starts to crimp your general purpose budget. So that's what's going on in our transportation budget. We are borrowing appropriately and then some. And I think it's widely agreed, Democrats and Republicans, that that's too high.
Transportation was a sticking point in the last budget. It's the big sticking point this time around. Do you see anything in the near future that might solve this so where we're not having this argument every 2 years?
You know, it's certainly not going to happen this time. If they do the hybrid electric, as I mentioned, it's not going to produce enough revenue to solve the problem. Ultimately, I think we need to go to VMT in the short run. I think we need a gas tax increase. This governor isn't going to allow that, so we'll see where it goes.
And do you think that Wisconsin taxpayers would accept either a vehicle mileage tax or a gas tax increase, or going back to gas tax indexing for that matter?
Sure they would. I think if they understand that this money is going in to fix their roads, to make them smoother, to take care of the potholes, to pave the shoulders, et cetera, to fix bridges, which are becoming more and more dangerous. I think if people understand where the money's going, yes, they'll support it.
Dave, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Dave Cheslevich, former mayor of Madison, now executive director for the Wisconsin Bicycle Federation. He wrote about the stalemate over transportation funding for Isthmus newspaper. By the way, later today on Central Time, we'll get an update on what's going on in the state's Joint Finance Committee, some apparent progress on the transportation budget and the overall budget plan. Coming up after the news, our guest says we need more student exchange programs within the United States to help bridge cultural and political divides. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's no secret that there are a lot of divisions in American culture and politics these days. Urban and rural, red state and blue state, black and white, north and south, no matter how you slice it, there are big groups of people who don't know each other, don't understand each other, and maybe don't like each other. Wisconsin is no exception. Research by the state's own Kathy Kramer shows a big divide between rural Wisconsin and the two biggest cities, Milwaukee and Madison. But there are efforts to close these gaps. Last week, we heard about a UW Green Bay program that took students on cultural outings to meet people from different backgrounds. And there are longer-term programs in the U.S. that let students live in a different part of the country, like an international student exchange program, but not international. Our next guest says we need to see a lot more of those exchanges to help different communities understand one another. Amanda Ripley wrote about this in the Wall Street Journal. She's a senior fellow at the Emerson Collective and the author of The Smartest Kids in the World and How They Got That Way. Amanda, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, before we get into these exchange programs, from where you're sitting, how bad are these divisions I was just talking about?
It's kind of frightening, actually. I mean, the more research that I look at, the more unsustainable it feels. You know, we haven't seen these level of divisions in recent memory. You know, right now in experiments with thousands of Americans, researchers have found that partisan animosity exceeds racial hostility. You know, a third of Democrats and half of Republicans say they'd be upset if their kids married someone from the other party. That's way up from past surveys asking the same question going back to the 60s. So the problem is there's really only two ways to get out of this kind of tribalism, according to the research into, you know, human behavior and psychology. And the two ways are either to have a new common enemy, to go to war against someone else, which isn't great, obviously, or to interact more with each other, to have human interactions that are not hostile, and to see that we are not, none of us is just one thing. We are all many things, and we can't be reduced to stereotypes. But it is, you know, obviously a longstanding human weakness to be tribal and to demonize others. And right now we are in a real spiral. So we know that if we could get more people talking from different parts of the country, from different viewpoints, we know if it were done in a way that was friendly and not scary, that we could chip away at some of this. But right now, it's just not naturally happening. People are more geographically segregated than ever before. So you don't encounter people through the draft or through your job or through other things that used to help mitigate against some of that tribalism.
So why exchange programs? Why do you see that as a valuable part of the solution?
Well, you know, I used to write about students in other countries, and it was really valuable to sort of follow kids, American teenagers, to other countries and see what they saw through their eyes in different schools and neighborhoods around the world. And the reason those exchange programs were all started was in order to avoid exactly the kind of demonization that we're seeing. You know, the theory was, one of the biggest ones called the American Field Service, which used to be a volunteer ambulance corps, actually, and they did a lot of brutal tours in Europe during World War One and World War Two. And after evacuating a concentration camp in Germany after World War Two, they decided to become an exchange program instead to try to prevent the kind of conflict that they were seeing. So starting in 1947, 53 kids from 11 nationalities came to the U.S. and France to study and live for 1 year among foreigners. And it just grew and grew and grew. And then in the 60s, you started seeing AFS, the same organization, and others start up exchanges within, in the 70s in particular, within the U.S. So what you started to realize is through the civil rights protests, anti-Vietnam protests, there was obviously a lot of tension then, too, in the country. And it looked like, you know, for a variety of reasons, it might be valuable to get Americans to other parts of America for the very same reasons. So we know that, you know, hundreds of students have done these over the years. They kind of faded away, some of them, in the 1980s, but some of them still exist through other organizations. AFS is mostly now international exchanges, but they're looking at reviving the domestic exchanges for these very reasons.
We're talking to Amanda Ripley about exchange programs, not just international ones, but getting people from different communities in the United States to go and live with a different community in hopes of bridging political divides, cultural divides, urban-rural divides, and more. So, Amanda, you looked at some of these currently existing programs. Can you talk about some of the exchanges that are going on right now that bring together people from different parts of the U.S.?
Sure. So there's an exchange, for example, that Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island still does and has done for many years with Tougaloo College, a historically black college near Jackson, Mississippi. So every year they send students in both directions. More than 500 students and faculty have participated in the exchange over the past 50 years. And the thing is, they stay past the point of discomfort, right? Like, it's not just a weekend or a day or a conference. They stay for a semester. And they really have to push through and forge some relationships. And it's difficult. It's difficult for both sides. It's really interesting talking to the students who had gone from Tougaloo to Brown and vice versa, the faculty as well. You know, there were students who had gone from Brown University to Amsterdam on exchange before in the Netherlands who found going to Tougaloo to be much more bewildering and disorienting. So there was a lot of, for everyone, to learn on both sides, and often the students end up teaching, the exchange students end up teaching their hosts as much as the hosts teach the exchange students, which is exactly the same as how it works internationally. So, for example, you know, I talked with a student who had grown up in Texas and Mississippi before spending a semester at Brown in the spring of 2015, and she found right away she really missed the Southern hospitality, you know, the way everyone would say hi on campus without fail. People in Brown seemed kind of cold and unwelcoming. And she did a presentation to her class about this and explaining why she valued Southern hospitality. And, you know, after that, everyone in that class would say hello to her without fail when she saw them on campus. So there's challenges on both sides. But in the end, she ended up applying to Brown, to med school, and she still finds herself playing the role of, you know, cultural ambassador, having to explain the South to doctors in training at Brown, which is incredibly valuable, right, for those students.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing reading what you wrote about people who did these exchanges in the United States, for all intents and purposes, going to a different part of the country, in some cases maybe even a different part of a state, can be like going to a foreign country.
It sounds crazy, right? Because we speak the same language in theory. But in fact, maybe because our expectations are that it won't be that different, the differences can be quite striking. It's the food, it's religion, it's the sort of norms around socializing. And, you know, one of the things that the students who go from Brown to Tougaloo notice is how integrated Christianity is into everything that happens at the school. You know, no meetings start without a Christian prayer. And this is something that if you don't understand that, you know, if you can't respect that on some level, you know, you're going to have a hard time fitting in this place. You don't have to be Christian, but you have to respect this ritual, right? And often what you find for the students going to the Northeast is that sometimes people, including professors, are sort of casually dismissive of Christianity in particular, in ways that are very patronizing. So, you know, there's a lot there and there's a lot of value, but it takes human interactions. You know, you have to eat a meal together, you have to talk to one another. And it's not the kind of interactions that we get online right now, unfortunately.
Well, I wonder, though, you know, people in the small southern town and the big northeastern city, say, might have stereotypes about each other. But when they go from one place to another, do they get past the stereotypes? Or isn't it possible that they can confirm their perceptions of their negative perceptions of each other in person?
That's a really good point. And you see that with the international exchanges, too. There's been a lot of research on this and the kind of predictable phases that people go through when they live in another country. You know, there's usually a phase of euphoria where you think it's amazing and you can't get over the croissants and whatever. But then over time, you feel kind of alienated. You miss being home. You might resent your host. So and you have to get to the other side of that, right? So you're right. You want to do this carefully and you want to do it in ways where you're mindful of the risk of leaving people more alienated. But in general, I don't think that's, from the people I've talked to, that doesn't tend to be what happens. That over time, look, you know, one of the great strengths of Americans, and I say this, you know, having had the privilege of living in many places, Americans are ultimately pretty good one-on-one. Like, we're pretty friendly. Like, not always. We have plenty of problems, but Americans are not as hard of a culture to break through, generalizing wildly here, but as other countries. So what I found is that, you know, when you have these kinds of interactions, if they're authentic, right, they have to be meaningful and they have to be sustained. What you find is that people begin to respect the complexity of each other, and it makes it much, much harder to reduce each other down to a stereotype or a monster or whatever we may be doing now.
Amanda Ripley is with us. We're talking about cultural exchange programs. She says we need more of them within the United States to help bridge political and cultural divides. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you like this idea? Do you think it is a good idea? Have you participated in some kind of exchange program within the U.S. or internationally, maybe through a school, a university, or a group like Rotary? What was that experience like for you? Did it change the way you thought about other people? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Amanda Ripley. She says we need more exchange programs within the United States so people can understand different people and communities around the country and maybe overcome some of the nation's cultural and political divides and some of the stereotypes that go along with them. You can join in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What do you think of this idea? Have you done something like this, some kind of exchange within the U.S. or other countries, maybe been a host family here in the United States? How did it change your life? Do you think it is a recipe for getting people of different perspectives together and making them understand each other a little better. Call in now at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to our callers. Brandon is with us in Oshkosh. Brandon, hi.
Yeah, hey there. So I just wanted to ask the guest. I had a friend who's an English teacher in Milwaukee tell me that in America, for social studies, he's a social studies teacher, not an English teacher, I apologize, that we use two textbooks. And in the South, they're basically taught that the Civil War is about Northern aggression. And in the North, we're taught that it's mostly about the abolishment of slavery. So if that's true, I was just curious what the guest has to say about that, because it seems like a systemic problem from the very beginning of our life.
Brandon, thanks for the call. Amanda, we're maybe not just brought up in different ways, but taught in different ways, depending on where we grew up in the country. And can we bridge that?
Absolutely. That's a really good point that Brandon makes. And it's one you hear. You know who I hear this from the most is actually children of military families, because they naturally do this. They move all over the country, and they get very different curricula from place to place. And they are very hip to this problem. They find, you know, math is really hard in, you know, Maryland and super easy in Georgia, depending on where they are. And they see huge differences culturally, also, you know, the sort of bias and slant that you get from place to place, but also the level of rigor. So that's something that students are particularly well positioned to see. So teachers, you know, it's not hard to imagine doing an exchange program like this targeting teachers. There are international exchange programs for American teachers and for teachers from other countries, because they are the ones, obviously, as Brandon's pointing out, that sort of start from a very early age this skew one way or another, or, you know, hopefully help us create a little bit more understanding and an empathy across divides. So that would be another way to do this. And it's interesting, since I did this piece for the Wall Street Journal, I've heard from a variety of groups that are trying to do exchanges in new ways that use technology to help us talk across partisan divisions. Maybe, you know, you sign up, there's the American Dialogue Project, where you sign up online and you give just a little bit of information about yourself, and they match you with someone who's very different from you, and you have a 40-minute phone call that's facilitated by a professional moderator. And then there's other ones that use FaceTime, and there's other ones where you meet at a coffee shop and Starbucks will pay for your coffee and that sort of thing. So there's different ways to do this. Those are more kind of one-off, right? Mm-hmm. Typically, they don't last for a year or 3 months like exchange programs have. But it's the same kind of concept, and I think it's worth watching and seeing which of these can really take off and involve more and more people.
Who would need to take the lead in order to make these more lengthy exchanges where, you know, a student maybe goes and lives with a host family for months at a time? Who needs to take that lead to bring that back and make it more of a reality?
Well, I think that the existing exchange programs would be a really good place to start. You mentioned Rotary programs. They run some amazing exchanges all over the world, and they're obviously located all over the country. So that would be a good one. AFS, which still exists and, again, is looking into trying to figure out a way to revive domestic exchange programs. In some ways, it's an easier sell for people because it tends to be a little cheaper than going to another country. Parents who might be nervous about their kids going abroad are a little less nervous about them going to Florida. So, you know, there is some opportunity here, particularly as families are more and more sort of stressed about studying abroad in college because of the expense. There is an opportunity, if it's done mindfully and carefully, to really bring people from other countries, from other states, sorry, through the U.S. as if it's multiple countries, which in some ways, you know, it is.
Let's go to another caller now. We've got Lucy with us in Madison. Lucy, hi.
Hi. I was involved in an exchange program called Project Self-Help and Awareness. It was a Wisconsin-Mississippi exchange program started during the Civil Rights Movement by a white lawyer from Wisconsin and a law student, I believe it was, and a black woman from Mississippi. And they would take trips down to Mississippi and stay with black people in Mississippi, and they would do bus trips for kids from Mississippi to come up and stay with families in Wisconsin. And it was usually more rural areas, families. For a couple of weeks, the kids would stay, so there would be this experience of a very different setting. And I went down there in, I think, the 80s and the 90s, my memory is not so great. And on some of these bus trips to help chaperone kids on the bus and help drive the bus sometimes. And we would stay with families for a day or two. And my experience of it was that I really did feel like I was in a different country. But it was kind of amazing because the black families that hosted us down there were just so welcoming and kind and warm. It just felt like we were we were coming to a very strange place and being welcomed in warmly. But at the same time, we also got some experience of what the apartheid kind of racism was there.
Lucy, thank you so much for sharing that experience. And Amanda, you were talking about that. That was something that was maybe more common for a couple decades there.
Yeah, and that's something that the people I interviewed who, like Lucy, had been on these programs really were struck by, was the warmth with which they were greeted. You know, you go with a lot of apprehension about what New York or Wisconsin or Illinois is like, and when you're greeted warmly, you can, you know, there's a lot of relief that comes with that, and a lot of open-mindedness. You know, when you share a meal with someone, when you hear their stories, you don't have to agree, you won't agree on everything, but it just, that human interaction is so critical. We know from, you know, Jonathan Haidt did a great book called The Righteous Mind a few years ago, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion. And one of the things that he articulates very well is that, you know, at a certain point, once you're kind of dug in on one side or the other on a political issue, it's impossible. No amount of facts is going to change your mind. That's just not the way the human brain works. The only way you will reconsider or modulate your position is through, you know, interactions with other human beings you kind of like. So that's really the only choice. And there is, Lucy's call reminded me of, there is an organization now called Better Angels that did a bus tour around July 4th this summer with very similar goal and is doing some other interesting things. So there are people trying to figure this out, but it is, the challenge is kind of, you know, getting, making sure people know about it and getting it to scale so that it's a, so that it involves millions instead of thousands of people.
Thanks for the call, Lucy. Time for another caller, Daniel in Milton. Daniel, hi.
Hi, how you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, do you have an experience to share?
Yeah, I'm close to 50. I'm back in 1985. I graduated high school a half year early, and I went to Israel for a year and a half. And part of what I did there was an exchange program. Well, it wasn't really an exchange program. It was just like a placement of foreign students. And I was placed with a Iraqi Jewish family in Jerusalem. Who's their family had been sort of chased out of Iraq back in the 40s. And it was really an eye-opening experience because, you know, having come from a totally different environment, I was introduced to people who really didn't have that much in terms of material wealth. I was given the laundry room to sleep in, basically. And I got just to see how people lived in such a very different way, you know, how they respected their elders and how they handled neighbors. And it was a really wonderful eye-opening experience that also helped open my eyes to, you know, more of my own Jewish heritage.
Daniel, thank you so much for the call. He repeated a phrase three times there, eye-opening, Amanda. As we wrap up, that's what this does, isn't it?
You know, what I found when I've spent a lot of time with exchange students, and what's really striking is how at a certain point they just become more at peace with uncertainty. They become more flexible in the world. Like they can sort of, like they've shrugged off a layer of assumptions and fears that holds us back from moving through the world and living a full life. And so that is something that I can't echo strongly enough, and experience everyone should have one way or another, whether it's within the U.S. or outside of the U.S., if you have the chance, I would do it.
Amanda, thanks a lot for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to Amanda Ripley, senior fellow at the Emerson Collective and author of the book The Smartest Kids in the World and How They Got That Way. Her piece on cultural exchange programs appeared in the Wall Street Journal. We have that linked over at the Central Time Facebook page. And I'm still interested to hear from you if you have done an exchange program. If you've participated as maybe a student yourself or a host family, tell us what you did, what organization you did it through, and most importantly, what it did for you. Did it change the way you looked at the world, the way you looked at people from a different culture, and as Amanda was saying, the way you deal with uncertainty and being in an unfamiliar environment? Again, read her article and share your experiences over at the Central Time Facebook page. If you were a kid or a parent in the right stretch of time, you may have fond memories of the magic school bus, and now the time-traveling bus is making a comeback on TV. Netflix released a trailer today for The Magic School Bus Rides Again. Kate McKinnon will take up the role of Ms. Frizzle, pioneered by Lily Tomlin. And in place of Little Richard on the theme song, it's Lin-Manuel Miranda, also known as the Hamilton guy. Central Time producer Dean Kinnetter has some fond memories of the original series. Hey, Dean.
Hey, Rob.
So you were a Magic School Bus fan as a kid.
It was appointment viewing in my household. Did not miss it. And actually, my parents, they filmed every episode.
So like they videoed on an old-fashioned VCR?
On VCR, VHS tape, yep. So after the first couple seasons, we had a little library of Magic School Bus episodes and topics. And eventually word got around my elementary school that we were sitting on this gold mine at the Kinnetter household. And so eventually teachers would come up to me and ask me, hey, you know, I'm teaching this topic. Do you have an episode for me? And usually I did.
That's great. And did you identify with any of the kids in particular?
Probably Carlos, because
Carlos.
I say a lot of bad jokes in the course of a day. I get a lot of blank stares.
Little Richard takes us out on Central Time.
So strap your bones right to the seat. Come on in and don't be shy.
Come on.
Just to make your day complete.